This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Tom Joslin and Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They are senior fellows. They and their colleagues keep the Long Word Journal. We go immediately to the question of, after the U.S. and ISAF withdraw from Afghanistan, what is to be done? The Wall Street Journal featuring a piece about the Afghanistan economy. Kabul, datelined within these hours. The U.S. spent $145 billion over 2 decades in Afghanistan to turn one of the poorest nations on earth into a self-sustaining economy. Afghanistan's economy did grow, and millions of Afghans gained access to education, health care, and jobs. But the economy that the U.S. helped build relies overwhelmingly on foreign aid, most of which evaporated overnight. Afghanistan's economy and the welfare of its people is on the verge of collapse following the U.S. exit last month. Bill, I come to you immediately for your report about the Afghan Taliban regime as we understand it so far. You're reporting that what we see is a series of leaders from the Taliban and their jihadist allies. Can we characterize this government as radical, as new, as capable of dealing with an economic collapse, such as the Wall Street Journal reports? Good day to you, Bill.
Good day, John. Yes, the Taliban government, I would characterize it as the Taliban always was, as the Taliban continues to be today. An overwhelming number of the current Taliban leaders are served in similar positions, if not the same position, of the previous Taliban regime of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001. So the Taliban's government is set up to mirror exactly what it was. There's just, you know, the people thought that the Taliban would moderate. They would build a government that would be inclusive, that they'd build a government that would satisfy concerns from the international community, that it would be moderate, things like that. And the Taliban did what it wanted to do and did what it said it was going to do all the time. Restore the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. It's done that. Appoint its emir as the overall, its current emir as the overall leader. And it's given top positions to the most influential commanders. Again, many of whom had served under the Taliban regime prior. Can this government deal with an economic crisis? I don't think it cares, John. Would it like to have the international aid flowing to alleviate its problems? Sure. But the Taliban's primary concern throughout all of this was to restore itself as the government, restore its Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and impose its harsh version of Sharia or Islamic law. That's what it's always wanted. The Taliban ruled for almost 5 years, from 96 to 2001, with only 3 countries recognizing it, with very little international aid coming in. It just, you know, I think a lot of too much press is put on, just as it was, that the Taliban would moderate, that the Taliban would negotiate, that it would put in, that it would, you know, it'd be in, have an inclusive government and appoint, you know, leaders from across the spectrum of Afghan society. That's exactly what, none of that happened. And I don't think the Taliban is going to be all overly concerned with an economic crisis, as long as it's ruling and ruling by the gun, which it's shown that it's been more than capable of doing in the past. The Taliban will continue to rule Afghanistan.
We have 2 profiles to turn to, Mullah Zakir and Sadr Ibrahim. But before that, Tom, your understanding of the Taliban, does it depend upon aid? Is it looking for a partner? There have been mentions in these last weeks of China, of Russia, of India, of people looking at Afghanistan as what's in it for us. Does the Taliban welcome that sort of conversation, Tom, or is it a rejectionist the way it was before?
You know, I think the Western-centric, the American-centric conception of Afghanistan and the economy there is just completely flawed. I mean, there's this whole idea that the Taliban needs Western aid and American aid in order to function for its government, and that this somehow gives leverage to the West. I just don't buy that at all. And one of the reasons why is because the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan now is surrounded by enablers. So the Chinese have indicated a willingness to do business. The Pakistanis, of course, are going to do business with them. They've been sponsoring the Taliban all along. You see that the head of Pakistan, Imran Khan, came out just recently and said that the world should recognize the Taliban's regime. The Iranians have been doing business with the Taliban. Some of the Central Asian states, not all of them, not Tajikistan, but other ones have been willing to play ball at given times, you know, at least at some level, the economic from the economic perspective. So I think they have a lot of players in the region that are willing to do business with the Taliban. I don't think they actually need American or European aid to get by.
The concern that the Wall Street Journal raises is that the people of Afghanistan are the ones who are going to feel the collapse of the economy, and that the Taliban is quite separate, quite distanced from the people of Kabul, let's say, where we have the best reporting sources, not magnificent, not transparent, but we have the best reporting sources. Is it your measure, Tom, that the Taliban regimes is indifferent to the poverty and the breakdown of the society, or is it, does it have another vision that of what stability looks like?
Yeah, I don't think they're indifferent. I think they would like their Islamic Emirate to prosper and to be wealthy and to have money and for the people to be living a good life there. I just think when push comes to shove, as we've seen in authoritarian regimes around the globe, if it comes down to the authoritarians, the autocrats, or the people, the autocrats are the ones that are going to get the money and are going to get the live the so-called high life compared to the people. I do think that they want the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan to be a model for governance for other nascent emirates elsewhere, including in Somalia and West Africa and possibly Syria and Yemen. And so they want to prosper, relatively speaking. But what they consider prospering and what you and I may consider prospering are two different things. I mean, they have a mode of existence that's much less than what we're accustomed to in the West. So I don't think that – I think that has to be factored into how we perceive of their relative success.
We will speak of al-Qaeda at length, Tom, but that is also true for al-Qaeda. The understanding from Zawahiri is that a collapsed economy is acceptable if it is an emirate of the Quran.
Yeah, I mean, I think as Bill alluded to or argued, you know, from 1996 to 2001, the economy wasn't exactly flourishing in Afghanistan, and yet they were happy because it was the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. I think that economically, because of the prosperous heroin and opium trade that they've got going, the drug trade, the fact that they've got, really have built up their network, their rear base economic network in Pakistan over the last 20 years. I think they probably have more sources of finances now than they did between 1996 and 2001. So, yeah, they would like, look, money is fungible, right? They would love for America to waste more taxpayer dollars on throwing money at Afghanistan and giving it to the Taliban regime so they can use money to do something else. But I think that they have a lot of different income streams that can keep them going in the meantime.
Bill, you've profiled two Taliban commanders or leaders who have joined the regime, one called Zakir, a.k.a. Zakir Abdullah Gulana Rasul. What is significant about his participation, Bill?
Yes, Mullah Zakir. He was a former detainee at Guantanamo Bay. The U.S. transferred him to Afghan custody in 2007. The Afghans released him in 2008. All the entire time, Tom's done a lot of work on Mullah Zakir, by the way. The entire time, he claimed he was innocent. He had nothing to do with the Taliban. He was thrust in a bad situation. And then immediately after he's released, he rejoins the Taliban. Is named the Taliban's commander in the South and basically the Taliban's surge commander, which meant that he was the Taliban's commander who countered the U.S. surge in the South. He became the minister, basically their head of their military commission by 2010. He was replaced in 2014, or he stepped down, according to the Taliban, but still remained in a military senior commander in the South. This isn't unusual. The Taliban routinely shuffle military and political leaders, particularly ones that are operating inside of Afghanistan during the insurgency. And now he's been appointed to the deputy minister of defense. He's another old school Taliban leader who has, ties to Al-Qaeda, close to the top leadership. You know, he's not the Taliban 2.0. Taliban 2.0 is Taliban 1.0. There was also rumors that Zakir and the other Taliban leader, Sadr Ibrahim, that they were furious at not being given senior positions within the Taliban government, and that there was a break and there was feuding. And yet here, within a month after the naming of the Afghan, or actually within a couple of weeks after naming the Afghan government, Zakir and Sadr Ibrahim both are given relatively senior levels positions. Zakir is the now a deputy minister of defense, and Sadr Ibrahim is a deputy minister of intelligence, reporting under Sirajuddin Haqqani. So, yeah, this is just more evidence that the Taliban is padding out its network with its old school hardline leaders. I continue to bristle at this idea of a moderate Taliban. I always say, name me one. People throw in Mullah Baradar. You know, and this is all just garbage, John. These are all the old school Taliban, powerful Taliban leaders leading within the Taliban's new government.
I'm speaking with Bill Raggio and Tom Jocelyn, the senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We're looking now at new members of the regime in Afghanistan, coterminous with the collapse of the economy, so reports the Wall Street Journal. When we come back, I'll speak with Tom about what we can expect for a man who is as well-known as Zakir, and what this means that he was in captivity, he was released, he was bartered, what this says about the Taliban's opinion of the U.S. and the West. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jocelyn and Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They are senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal. I highly recommend the Long War Journal as a way to watch not only Afghanistan as it goes through a collapse, according to the Wall Street Journal reporting, of its economy and the beggaring of its people. We will notice immediately, because there are good lines of communication from inside Afghanistan to the refugees, the migrants who are outside of Afghanistan, we will have brutal reports of the poverty and the darkness that is descending on the people of Afghanistan. But we need to understand the leadership and the direction it can go. Tom, Bill mentions that you have written extensively, reported extensively, over the five Taliban leaders who were detained, and then they were at Doha. And now one of them, Zakir, is back in government. Is there any way that we can take Zakir's profile and speculate about where the Taliban is going, whether it's a transnational threat, whether it's a threat to the region, or whether now it's going to change its ways and lead as a government?
So Zakir is actually the sixth former Gitmo detainee who is now in the Taliban leadership circles, or either four of the former detainees who were traded for Bo Bergdahl in 2014 are now ministers in the Taliban's government. A fifth is the governor in Khost, and now Zakir is a deputy minister. And I'll give you one anecdote about Zakir's time at Guantanamo that I learned from several sources. This speaks to the failed war effort and how really pathetic America was during this whole 20 years in terms of understanding what was going on. When Zakir was held at Guantanamo, the Red Cross and some of the others who were representing the detainees and working with the detainees delivered to him the writings of Mao. And the argument was that Zakir could read these writings of Mao and to show that he wasn't really a committed jihadist because, well, he's reading the communist Mao, right? So he's not a jihadist. The stupidity of this, of course, is that Mao was the ultimate insurgent. And the reason why Zakir was studying Mao's writings was he's preparing for his career as a master insurgent once he gets out of Guantanamo. And of course, he's delivered these writings against the will of Joint Task Force Guantanamo, which oversees the operation. And so Zakir studies Mao during his time. He uses his time in American custody, in other words, in order to improve himself as a military commander. And then as soon as he gets out of Guantanamo, as Bill said, he's appointed a senior military position with the Taliban's command, showing that, of course, he was well respected all along. And eventually he becomes becomes the commander who's in charge of countering President Obama's so-called surge. So literally America let out from Guantanamo, allowed a guy, sidelined him, allowed him to train himself and educate himself on insurgency warfare, lets him out, and he immediately becomes the anti-surge commander for the Taliban's forces. And the reason why I say this is pathetic is because a lot of the narrative on Guantanamo, for example, is framed in sort of a hard left framework in which all these guys were tortured and they're all innocent. But when you go through the dossiers of guys like Zakir, he was never tortured and he wasn't innocent. In fact, he was just a senior jihadi who was detained by the U.S. The U.S. lets him go and he immediately gets back to killing on behalf of the Taliban and, in fact, Al-Qaeda, which he's closely allied with. And that story is much more common, actually, through the experience of Guantanamo over time.
And Bill, Sadr Ibrahim, what is significant about his new role in the government in Afghanistan?
Yeah, he was close to Mullah Omar, the founder of the Taliban, and Mullah Mansour, who was the second leader of the Taliban. He's probably one of the most effective Taliban military commanders, Zakir as well. They're on par. From 96 to 2001, he served as the deputy defense minister for the Taliban. So now he's the deputy minister of the interior. He's going to be playing a key role in securing Afghanistan and providing intelligence and hunting down any Islamic State fighters who are going to oppose the Taliban regime. Sadr Ibrahim was designated in 2008. By the United States, as well as the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center. That's a group of seven nations. He worked closely with the Iranians to get support, including Iranian trainers to help help build up the Taliban's tactical and combat capabilities. That's a direct quote from the designation. He was the one who replaced Mullah Zakir as the head of the military committee in 2014. Then in 2020, he was replaced by Mullah Yaqub, who was Mullah Omar's brother. Probably not because Yaqub was probably named the head of the military commission, probably more because of his name recognition being Mullah Omar's son, as opposed to, you know, so the final victory would go to Mullah Omar's son as the military leader, more so than any problem with Ibrahim's skills as a military leader. Because let's face it, when he was replaced in 2020, the Taliban were ascendant. They positioned themselves for the takeover. Again, it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss here. You know, Ibrahim, like Zakir, top level positions, if influential, decades of experience in serving with the Taliban, both in while it was a government and then while it was an insurgency. And it's just more evidence that the Taliban, not that we need it. Tom and I were convinced of this years ago that the Taliban was going to rule the way it wanted to rule and not the way the West wants it to rule.
To your understanding, Bill, did Sadr Ibrahim ever spend any time in captivity, or has he been operating these years without that?
No, my understanding, he's never been in captivity that I've been aware of. He spent time in Pakistan, and I believe he spent time in Iran as well, although I don't have direct evidence of that, given his relationship with the Iranian regime. And there are reports that he had a falling out. He was upset with the Pakistanis for detaining Taliban leaders and things of that nature. So there's reports that he either was operating in Afghanistan, but very likely operating inside Iran for a period of time in order to establish that relationship.
I'm speaking with Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is an analysis of what we know about the government in Kabul and the Taliban's presentation to the world. Bill mentions the Islamic State. When we come back, I will ask Tom about the Islamic State as a threat to the Taliban, or what role it is now playing in the larger understanding of the Islamic State transnationally. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Joslin, Bill Raja. They keep the Long War Journal. They are also the podcasters of Generation Jihad, where they discuss, and often with their colleagues and guests, the changing face of the jihadists across a vast landscape, the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. Right now we're looking at Afghanistan because it's going through severe changes since the last 20 years of an economy that was being guided and supported by the U.S. and its allies with subsidies and with investment. That economy has now gone away. You can all imagine what your economy in your local area would look like if the electricity and the water and the gas and the salaries disappeared overnight, and then you had to make arrangements with new people, new bosses, whose direction is not about prosperity, but is about obedience. Tom, I come to you because Bill mentions that one or all of the new commanders he's profiled, his job is to seek out the Islamic State, sometimes called by those who are fresh to this reporting, ISKP, Islamic State Khorasan Province. I remember when Bill first reported on the Khorasan Province and there was a photograph of young people stringing a banner that looked extremely bought at Targets that said Khorasan Province, but it's considerably more than. There was that incident where the U.S. dropped a super bomb said to be targeting the Islamic State. What is its status in Afghanistan, Bill? I mean, Tom. And we have this fresh report from the Wall Street Journal. Killings of Islamic State militants highlight power struggle with Afghanistan's Taliban. What does that power struggle look like, Tom?
Well, ever since the ISIS branch entered the region in 2014, it's opposed the Taliban's rule. It's opposed the Taliban's Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan. In the ISIS scheme, they supposedly represent the caliphate, and wherever the caliphate goes, even though they've lost the territorial caliphate in Syria and Iraq, anywhere the caliphate goes, including Afghanistan and Pakistan, they think that they have the right to rule. And so they don't recognize the legitimacy of the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, even though they share many points in common, ideologically and otherwise. In fact, the earliest iterations of the ISIS presence in Afghanistan and Pakistan were basically just a series of commanders who defected from the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, for various reasons to the ISIS camp, and then basically got into conflict with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, by the way. So it's the Taliban and Al-Qaeda on one side and ISIS on the other. And so what we've seen in recent weeks is that the ISIS has conducted small-scale operations, mainly in Jalalabad and some other places against the Taliban. These are roadside bombs, IEDs that they've detonated under Taliban convoys. I would expect that sort of low-grade sort of attacks against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to continue. However, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda really are the big dogs in this fight, and they control the turf. They're the ones that took over the country, and I don't expect that the ISIS will be able to supplant them at all.
Bill, I read from the Wall Street Journal report, it's bloodthirsty, but it is a way of imagining what this contest looks like, given the non-transparency. The Taliban are working to choke any challenge, writes the Wall Street Journal, to their rule as they transition from a guerrilla-style insurgency to a government, said Saifullah Haroon, a Taliban intelligence officer in Zabul. We don't differentiate between Islamic State and Americans. For us, they are the same. Anywhere they rise up, we finish them. Mr. Haroon said he recently sought to arrest an Islamic State cleric in a village near Makrak, but failed and instead detained his son. He played down the threat now posed by the group. We killed all of them, he said about Islamic State fighters, but denied any involvement in the death of Mullah Ibrahim. What is your measure, Bill, of the reporting coming out of Afghanistan? Islamic State has an effective media presence, and the Taliban is making remarks to the Wall Street Journal, which seems like they've been upgraded here for their media presence. How should we regard these single reports of we killed them all?
Yeah, I suspect that this Taliban intelligence officer saying he killed them all in his area, he may be correct. It's difficult to assess the viability of these reports, given the situation. The Taliban is very effective with Western reporters in showing them exactly what they want you to see. And you don't really, if you're a Western reporter embedded with the Taliban, so to speak, you don't really get to strike out and go and figure out the facts for yourselves, go interview local residents in the area without a Taliban handler on your shoulder. So you're not going to get accurate quotes from individuals. Like, so for instance, this article you were talking about here, they have some residents there that are being quoted. They say things like, he must have done something, you know, or things like that. You know, he probably was a bad guy, but who knows what the local residents really thought about this one Taliban, or I'm sorry, this one Islamic State aligned cleric that was killed. So gathering the reporting is very difficult. I'm with Tom 100%. The Taliban are ascendant in this struggle. The Islamic State, we don't know what the numbers are. Thousands, could be 10,000. Who knows? But the Taliban is, you know, a lot of these Islamic State fighters were members of either the Afghan or Pakistani Taliban or of Al-Qaeda. And so they're very well known. So it's a matter of the Taliban going and rooting them out, of finding them and rooting them out of communities. I've maintained even before the fall of the Afghan government that when the Taliban turns its eye to rooting out the Islamic State, it would very likely be it would very likely have success in doing so, because, you know, as the Islamic State was there and taking shots at the Afghan government and U.S. soldiers and whatnot, it served a purpose for the Taliban. It destabilized the area, even if it did provide challenges to the Taliban regime. But now the Taliban can focus all of its efforts on rooting out the Islamic State. They know who many of them are. They know where they live. They know where they're operating. And, you know, the safe haven that existed for the Taliban in Pakistan, that's not the case for the Islamic State inside Pakistan. That safe haven has been key, both in Pakistan, which was primary, and maybe call it secondary or tertiary in Iran. The Islamic State has no such place to fall back to regroup. So the Taliban can grind them down over time.
Tom, your report some days past about the Islamic State's attack in Jalalabad, the capital of Nangarhar province. You include a still photo from what you report is a 17-second video showing an IE attack on a Taliban convoy. This is from the Amaq news agency. You've taught me over the years to pay attention to Amaq because it's a sophisticated operation attached to ISIS. Is this attack a one-off, or do we believe that ISIS has capabilities in some parts of the country that allow it to make an IED attack, and can they strike again like this?
You know, since I wrote that, John, there have been other small-scale attacks by ISIS against the Taliban in Afghanistan. So they have this low-grade ability to keep sniping at the Taliban, basically. But, you know, much of what the Taliban is going to do and Al-Qaeda is going to do in resistance to this and to put them down is not going to be publicized. I mean, we see some of it in the reporting in terms of them cracking down on the ISIS network, but I suspect there's a lot more going on along those lines than we even realize.
And the Jalalabad attack, that is the road to the Khyber Pass. That is the traditional exit and entrance of Pakistan to Pakistan. Is ISIS also a threat to Pakistan that close to the Pakistani government? Is it extending itself? As Bill says, ISIS doesn't have a natural sanctuary. Does that mean it's capable of striking against its neighbor?
Yeah, ISIS conducts regular attacks in Pakistan as well. They inherited some of the Pakistani Taliban's networks, which are intertwined with the Afghan Taliban. But the Pakistani Taliban is basically the arm of the Taliban Al-Qaeda nexus that is most responsible for attacking the Pakistani state. And they're much more prolific than ISIS is, but ISIS still has a presence and still has the ability to attack inside Pakistan. And, you know, one of the reasons why these attacks occurred in Jalalabad, John, we suspect, is that during the prison breaks that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda conducted during these offensive this year against the Afghan government, you know, a good number of ISIS guys got out of prison. So a lot of, you know, thousands of Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters got out and some leaders. I suspect that also, you know, probably at least hundreds of ISIS guys got out as well. And one of those prison breaks occurred in Jalalabad, where ISIS had a presence. So I think they got some manpower back into the fold during those prison breaks.
Bill, you and Tom and your colleagues have had good communication with CENTCOM these many years of Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera. Does CENTCOM continue to report on Afghanistan, or have they gone, have they moved in another direction?
Yeah, CENTCOM isn't in Afghanistan anymore. The last reporting we had from CENTCOM was on the withdrawal and then the evacuation. So I haven't seen anything coming out of CENTCOM since August, I guess that would be 31st, when the U.S. withdrew, except for the reporting on the drone strike that killed the 10 Afghans in Kabul. That's the extent of the reporting from CENTCOM on Afghanistan. It's almost like Afghanistan has gone down the memory hole for CENTCOM. I think some individuals within the Department of Defense are quite happy with this result. Afghanistan has been a thorn in the side for the U.S. military. It's been a difficult presence. And, you know, Afghanistan going away is an issue, and CENTCOM getting to deal with issues that they much more prefer to do, with missions they prefer to do, is probably a good thing. I mean, there's really not much that CENTCOM can say about Afghanistan anymore, other than it played a major role in losing the war in Afghanistan, and that it's run by the Taliban.
And no comments on ISIS, which we know is a transnational threat. No comments on these ISIS events.
No, it's not something that the CENTCOM is going to concern itself with, particularly with Taliban, ISIS infighting.
Right.
The only thing where CENTCOM would deal with would be the over the horizon strikes, which really are over the rainbow strikes, that if they would have to execute them, or whether that would be CENTCOM or CIA. That's the only time where CENTCOM is really going to get involved here.
We're going to Syria. We're going to Syria with Tom. Tom, just a moment. We're going to go to Syria and your comment as well. Tom Jocelyn, Bill Rajo, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal and their conversation on their podcast, Generation Jihad, not only now, but in the weeks prior to these events, significant because they and their colleagues pick up on incidents that later on are lend themselves to interpretation across a large landscape. We're going to Syria next and Al-Qaeda. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jocelyn, Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, discussing Afghanistan after the withdrawal. However, Tom, you have featured a target by the U.S. of an al-Qaeda leader in Idlib, Syria, reminding us there are many more theaters operating besides Afghanistan. But you had a comment, Tom, so that first about Afghanistan.
You know, John, you asked about CENTCOM commenting on Afghanistan. I think you know, a couple of things I'd say about this final weeks here of CENTCOM's so-called reporting on Afghanistan. I mean, the first thing is that CENTCOM released a picture of the final U.S. soldier leaving Kabul. And they did this as some sort of bizarre point of pride, as if this was something to boast about. And it was totally strange. I mean, you know, they just lost the war. The Taliban, Al-Qaeda just took over the country. And they put out this picture of the last American soldier, and the picture is done through night vision. You know, the green night vision, as if this is a point of pride or something to boast about. And of course, the jihadis picked up on this very quickly and integrated this into their propaganda. So both Taliban and Al-Qaeda accounts use this picture that was put out by CENTCOM in a clueless fashion as a point of propaganda. They compared that picture to the last scenes of the Soviets leaving, for example, or to drawings and artistic renderings of the British leaving Afghanistan. So it just shows how really clueless I think the American side was about this war and how it was an orphaned war. Nobody really wanted responsibility for it or even to fight it in the end. The second thing is real quick is that, you know, CENTCOM also, you know, is boasting about their night vision capabilities in tweets saying we own the night and showing these types of images. And Bill, you know, somewhat snarkily, but I think this was good snark, said, you know, you tweeted on top of it that you just posted about how you own the night. Well, Afghanistan, you know, the Taliban owns Afghanistan and many of your night vision goggles, which you lost vis-a-vis the Afghan forces that crumbled and also through direct raids by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for the years. And this is something that when you look at how the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are the kits they have, the special forces kits that they put together for their people, they often include night vision goggles themselves. And so it just, again, was just completely clueless messaging from the U.S. military, which was has really been out to lunch on this for a long time.
We go immediately to your report on a drone strike, a U.S. drone strike in Idlib province, Syria, the remaining province that is dominated by jihadists, including al-Qaeda and their kindred. A still photo, I'm presuming, provided by the al-Qaeda or its media arm immediately after a drone strike. What do we know about this attempt, and was it successful? Because I don't see a martyr tape here.
No, there's no martyrdom statement so far, although some jihadis have said that a Tunisian al-Qaeda operative was killed. Again, when you look at the statement that was put out by CENTCOM, it was terse, didn't provide any real details, certainly didn't explain how this figure who was targeted in Idlib connects to the broader al-Qaeda network or why he was targeted versus others who are operating in Idlib or elsewhere. There's really no explanatory narrative for any of this at this point. It's all unhinged from the public discourse. It's just a sort of a random statement of a couple lines saying, hey, we targeted this senior al-Qaeda leader in Idlib and go team. But the jihadis reported that he was a Tunisian ideologue who works for Hurs al-Din, which is one of the al-Qaeda outfits in Syria. As we've talked about, Bill, the jihadi scene and John, the jihadi scene is a total mess in Idlib. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is this al-Qaeda offshoot. There's a whole messy story there about its role in the al-Qaeda network and this disassociation they had from al-Qaeda. They dominate al-Qaeda. There's this lesser group, a smaller group known as Hurs al-Din, which is still functioning and still reportedly has thousands of members. And this guy was supposedly a leading figure in that group.
And we do not have the success, but does CENTCOM speak of al-Qaeda? Are they specific that this was an al-Qaeda leader?
Yeah, they say he was a senior al-Qaeda leader, but they don't explain what that means. And so when you say he's a senior al-Qaeda leader, okay, Hurs al-Din certainly is part of al-Qaeda, and I can certainly make the case that he was a senior al-Qaeda leader, but they don't explain why he stands out to them. Why, of the thousands of jihadis who are in Idlib, why is he the one that needed to be targeted? What was he doing that needed to be targeted? They don't explain any of this. And that's part of the problem we have at this point. And why that's important is because we don't think the U.S. government, and we've documented this, Bill and I, for years, the U.S. government doesn't have a working, functional model of al-Qaeda. So when they say they targeted this guy from al-Qaeda, yes, he probably was a senior al-Qaeda leader based on what jihadis are saying. But there's no explanatory narrative for the American people to understand this threat as it goes on here. And that's part of what's sowing confusion about this war fighting that you're still seeing 20 years later.
Bill, I read a report that Thomas provided from September 2019 from the State Department about al-Qaeda leadership and naming some of the al-Qaeda leaders. Is your information from the U.S. State Department or the U.S. Department of Defense, does it characterize al-Qaeda as reawakening, as bigger than we thought it was, as more widespread? How does it regard an organization that I think has been declared dead as many times as Dracula?
Yeah, the common characterization of al-Qaeda these days is that it's been degraded. I mean, it's contradictory, actually. Even President Biden in his speeches says al-Qaeda is degraded and yet it's metastasized across the globe. And that was his justification for leaving Afghanistan to the Taliban, which is closely allied with al-Qaeda and isn't resurgent there, but has always been there, as Tom and I argued. So it's been a muddled mess of confusion from the U.S. State Department, from the Department of Defense, from the CIA, as far as what al-Qaeda is and their importance in the global jihad. Most of the attention has been put on the Islamic State, and that is because of the Islamic State's ability to take over significant portions of Syria and Iraq from 2014, and they held those areas from 2018. But it discounts the fact that Shabab, al-Qaeda's branch in Somalia, controlled territory twice, that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula controlled significant portions of territory in Yemen twice between 2011 and 2016, that the Taliban is now in control of Afghanistan while the Taliban's alliance with al-Qaeda is enduring. So the U.S. government has failed in this 20 years of war of defining what al-Qaeda is, what its place is in the global jihad, who the enemies are. That's what Tom had talked about with the jihadist from Huris al-Din who was killed in Syria. That's this war in a nutshell. It's we're getting little pieces of information, but there's never an effort to put the picture together and explain it to the American public. But if particularly after a nearly, I'd say, a decade of wanting to end the so-called endless wars, you don't make those cases because when you if you actually honestly looked at this, you'd realize that maybe you might want to stay engaged if this enemy was stronger.
Bill Raggio, Tom Jossin, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They are senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal. I highly recommend it as a way to follow the jihadists across a vast landscape as we go forward with the Taliban in a country, Afghanistan, that is headed to disaster, catastrophe, darkness visible. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills. Accelerate your team's impact. And redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.